You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC. I'm Julie Burstein. I'm in for Leonard Lopate today. Journalist Michael Lewis can take a complex subject like the economy and, with the skills of a novelist, create a narrative that helps us get underneath the skin. He did this with his bestseller, The Big Short, in which he tackled the U.S. financial crisis. And out of that reporting grew his latest book, Boomerang, Travels in the New Third World. Many of these essays recently appeared in Vanity Fair, where he's a contributing editor. In Boomerang, he looks at the global economy, in particular at European nations that have come so close, it's hard to say so close, it may be this close to the brink of economic collapse, and explores what is not a simple question, and that is, why? The book is published by W.W. Norton, and I'm very pleased to have Michael Lewis back on the show. Welcome.
Thank you.
So you begin this book by introducing us to a character who, as you say, fell onto the cutting room floor for The Big Short, a man named Kyle Bass. Tell us about him.
Kyle Bass runs a hedge fund in Dallas, Texas. And he came onto my radar screen when I was working on The Big Short because he was one of a handful of people who'd made a whole lot of money betting on the collapse of the subprime mortgage bond market. And so he had exhibited prescience or luck the first financial crisis. And I'd gone to see him in 2008. And when I got to him, what was curious is that even though he'd had this great triumph, he wasn't terribly interested in talking about the subprime mortgage bond. He said, this was just act one. Act two is about to happen. So what's act two? And he and his team basically done the following exercise. It said, all right, the response to this, to Lehman Brothers failing and the financial panics is for governments everywhere to basically take on the obligations of their banks, to say our banking system is too big to fail. If you add the debts of the banks to the debts that these sovereign nations have already incurred, some of these sovereign nations actually can't afford to pay it off. Some of them can't afford to bail out their banks. Which ones? And he'd made these bets against Greece, Iceland, Ireland, Spain. He got some of them wrong. One of the bets was against Switzerland, but because he made him, he was wrong about how the Swiss would regard their own banks, their assets outside of the United States.
And he was very hopeful that we wouldn't fail first because he didn't bet against us.
Well, he didn't bet. His bet was the nature of these a lot of hedge funds is they're betting against something, but they're betting on something too at the same time. It isn't just a purely short selling fund. And his isn't. And he's long, relatively bullish in the United States. But he made these bets on countries defaulting on their debts at a time when the markets were saying it was unthinkable. They were basically almost looked like free bets in the prices he was given to make these bets. The odds were so long.
Well, you write that in betting, I think, against, I can't remember which country, it was $1,100 for $1 million of...
To make a million. And that was Greece. So the markets were saying, this is a highly improbable event. And his own investors were saying, you look, Kyle, you were really smart about the subprime crisis, and you were probably a little lucky. You got right one highly improbable event, this financial debacle. You've come intoxicated with the idea that you can predict unpredictable events. And he was saying, basically, I don't have to predict the timing of this because of the nature of the bet. I'm buying an option. You know, I can sit with this bet for a long time and it can move against me and I'll still be okay. I'm just saying that, look, the numbers are, you can't argue with the numbers. Greece can't afford the debts that it's accumulated. Something's got to give. And so, anyway, I met him in 2008, and that picture that he was telling me this story, and I thought, what you're describing is total chaos. The only reason that the financial crisis was resolved is the governments were credible. They could step in and say, we'll guarantee the banks, and everybody said, believe it. What happens if you can't believe the governments? So I said to him, you know, in that environment, you're talking about a highly combustible sort of situation. I said, well, you know, what do you... this future you're foreseeing, when you're talking to your mother about where to put her money, what do you tell her? And he said, He said guns and gold. And
at that point,
I said, I'm out of here.
Yeah, that was one of the moments where I went, uh-oh.
So, the gold, because that's going to be the only thing that holds its value, and the guns to protect the gold.
And right? He said, not even the paper about the gold. You have to have a physical bar of gold.
Well, he pulls out from his desk big bars of platinum. And he had actually gone so far. It was wonderful, actually. He's a great character. He had gone so far as to analyze the metal content of the nickel, the common nickel, and discovered that the metal in the nickel was worth almost 7 cents. So he had gone and bought 20 million nickels, and he had them stored in a Brinks facility.
Reading about him was fascinating, and he said something which was very powerful, which is, it almost felt like this is the thunder that follows the lightning, that we've just suppressed something and it's got to come out somewhere else, that what happened in 2008 by the actions of the governments suppressed something from happening, and now we're going to wait for the next thing to happen.
Yes, and what we're in is Act Two. And so I realized that while I'm writing The Big Short, and Iceland goes down, and Greece goes down, and Portugal goes down, and Ireland goes down, that, oh my God, this guy was right. Not right in every detail, but generally right. And I asked the question, basically, why? You know, why is it that all these other places are going down too? This looked like principally an American phenomenon to me at first, and it wasn't. It was a global phenomenon where banks became incontinent. They relaxed their lending standards. They became numb to risk. And they made available vast sums of money to people and countries that shouldn't have had vast sums of money made available to them, and presented all these different societies with a singular temptation. They were left alone in a dark room with a pile of money and asked, basically, what do you want to do with it? And it turned out that each country, each society, had a different answer to that question. And that told you a lot about the place. So I went on this journey, going to look at the places and what they did with the money.
I'm speaking with Michael Lewis. You may know him from Moneyball or from The Big Short. And his new book is Boomerang, Travels in the New World. And it is from W.W. Norton. So you embarked on this journey and you started in a country that we haven't heard much about lately, but we heard a lot about a couple of years ago, and that's Iceland. What did you find there?
They're still marching in the streets in Iceland, but there are only 300,000 of them, so they make only so much noise. Iceland... The first person I talked to before I went into Iceland was the head of the IMF delegation who was being sent in to sort out the mess. Iceland had, in a matter of 5 or 6 years, taken its three modest-sized banks and ballooned them into three global powerhouse banks. So we're talking about a country the size with a population of Peoria, Illinois, that had three global banks that had accumulated assets of $140 billion. And they had done it recklessly. They'd borrowed money from overseas to go and buy Danish newspapers and Indian power companies and British soccer teams and to turn themselves into these tycoons. And the head of the IMF delegation said to me after he came out, "It's the most amazing thing I've ever seen. It's not a country anymore. It's a hedge fund that's gone down." And he said, and there were no people there who had the ability to do any of this stuff, had any experience with it. They were fishermen who got off their boats and dressed in black and pretended to be bankers. And this was a place that had been fantastically successful in its own way. But it had, up till 2002, it had made its money by fishing. It was a nation of fishermen.
And writers. There are writers.
They're writers. Well, the fishing policy was so intelligently managed, they generated wealth. And with the wealth, they invested the wealth in education. Very highly educated population. And when they looked for education outside of Iceland, they looked to us. They came to places like Wharton and learned business from us. And it's not surprising in a way that a highly educated population, affluent population, might become dissatisfied with fishing for a living. It's a brutal way to make a living. It's really a hard way to make a living. And they were presented by the global financial markets with the opportunity to become investment bankers instead. And they seized on it. And we're talking overnight. I went to you go to the university in Iceland, in Reykjavik, and the professors of economics said, we used to teach everybody fisheries, economics of the fisheries. And overnight, people were coming in, and all they wanted to do was learn the Black-Scholes option pricing model.
And what happens when you go from a country that deals with actual physical things like fish to this? I mean, your first book, your book was Liar's Poker. And to a civilian like me, I look at all of this and think, this is just gambling. This is just high stakes gambling with money that doesn't often represent anything.
The story that Liar's Poker tells is in some way our version of the Iceland story, but mm-hmm. we're so big we can handle it.
Right.
We had a little ice. We have Iceland inside us, and they got the idea from us. Their notion of what a money person did, they got from us. They were a parody. It was like a child imitating a parent. What happens? Well, your sense of it, that there's, because it's an abstraction, money, and fish is not, it's easy to be unrealistic about it. So, for example, one of the characters I met, a wonderful character, a fisherman named Stefan Olsson. And Stefan Olsson was in his early 30s, and he'd started training to be the captain of a fishing trawler when he was 16. And you listen to him talk about it, it's like I imagine it would be listening to talking to Italian Renaissance painters talk about their masters.
Yes.
They're almost school of fishermen. And he learned all these tricks. He was clearly a wonderful fisherman and highly trained, highly skilled. And all of a sudden someone says, Stefan, you know, it's hard making that money, you know, making what you're making as a fisherman. Come work at the bank and you will double your salary and you can trade currencies. And he literally walked off of his fishing trawler into one of these banks in Iceland, and in 3 days was a currency trader. And I sit there and I say to him, look, you're wonderful at fishing. It took you 15 years to get to where you are as a fisherman. What made you think that in 3 days you could be a foreign exchange speculator? And he starts laughing. He realizes how absurd it was, but it didn't seem absurd in the moment because for a period of years, because it was a Ponzi scheme, these Icelanders thought they were successful. And this is the other thing that's curious about money. The way you can create the illusion of success and sustain it for a while without there actually anything concrete to show for it.
Without that platinum bar.
Without that big fish that you pulled
out,
that you
fish.
Actually caught. And that's right. And that this very small nation, 300,000 people, they all know each other, right? I mean, it's that small. The men in the society who have been the chief breadwinners, they're the fishermen, they announce to presumably their wives and girlfriends that they're going to stop fishing and they're going to start banking. The women go obviously say, you must know what you're doing. You've known what you're doing so far. You know, go ahead. It seems like a great success. The whole society participates in this uproarious event for 4 or 5 years. And then all of a sudden it comes crashing down. It comes crashing down when people realize that they don't know what they're doing and when there's panic in the financial markets and the foreign people who lent the money want their money back and it turns out that the money was invested badly and so on and so forth. And they have $100 billion in losses. What's interesting to me was the gender split. The people who created this event in Iceland were men. The political party that deregulated the banks was a man's party.
Why am I not surprised?
Well, you're not surprised, but you got to think about this for a minute, the implications of this. The people who ran the banks and did the trading were men. When it all goes bad, what happens? The women take charge. The women roll into the banks and they become more important in the banks. The Iceland government falls and the first lesbian head of state is elected. There is a awareness that the men did not know what they were doing, and it was a male phenomenon. And it is a male phenomenon. And people who studied behavior in the financial markets have pointed out that male overconfidence is responsible for a lot of problems, not just in Iceland, but also in our markets. And so they were reflecting back on us, problems that infect us. And this was the story of all the places I visited. I felt like I was seeing distant mirrors. I was seeing different versions or different expressions of the American problem.
I'm speaking with Vanity Fair contributing editor Michael Lewis about his latest book, Boomerang: Travels in the Third World, which is published by W.W. Norton. We'll be back with more after a break. This is the Leonard Lopate Show. I'm Julie Burstein in for Leonard today, and I'm speaking with the journalist Michael Lewis about his new book, Boomerang, Travels in the New Third World by W.W. Norton. Michael, before we broke, you were talking about the gender differences, and it brought me back to reading Liar's Poker and seeing the first scene in that where you talk about one of the people you worked with's incredible ability to bluff or to just be impassive. And is that part of this? You were just a moment ago talking about sort of male overconfidence, but is also that kind of desire to better the next person part of what's going on here too?
Well, absolutely. I mean, what was going on Wall Street in part is this kind of this status war. I mean, right? People, it's guys competing with each other to make the most money. And it isn't because they actually need the most money or know even what they want to do with the most money. It's that they want to be the guy who has the most money. It's scorekeeping going on. And in Iceland, that's what happened too. The minute the money was introduced as the way of competing with each other, they competed with each other that way.
After you left Iceland, did you think the story would be different in different places, or did you find that the story had threads that carried through from one country to another?
So what connected these stories, in my mind, was the original, the cause, the total collapse of credit analysis in banks, the total absence of sense of risk in making loans. And the temptation, everybody was subjected to the same temptation. That and that I felt everywhere I went, there was some distant echo of what was going on in our own country. But apart from that, I felt that each society generated its own peculiar hell. It created its own problem. So if you went from Iceland to Greece, in Iceland it was very clear the banks and the patterns of behavior that created the banks sunk the country. The country, it was these private institutions that had been totally deregulated that caused this problem. It was not government intervention. In Greece, the country sank the banks. The banks were actually sleepy backwater 1950s-like places where people didn't make very much money. And their mistake was they bought Greek government bonds. And the Greeks, when they were left alone in a dark room with a pile of money, what they really wanted to do was bloat their government. And what it exposed is how they used their government. They used their government to plunder, and they cheated their government. They cheated on their taxes, and they all regarded the government as a spoil system. And it had been that for some time. The ability for the government to borrow increased it to grotesque proportions. So the presence of money had a sort of exaggerated character traits in the society.
When you would go to a new country, how would you begin to find the people who would help you tell that story? How, as a journalist, and especially as people knew the stories that you were telling, how did you begin to find the human stories that would tell this big global
story? That's a very good question. No one has asked me that question. And it's a question, obviously, I had to think about because I was a stranger to most of these places. First call was always to the IMF. I knew people in the IMF, and they were very helpful, and especially in the beginning because they were incredulous. They could not believe that they were being brought into these putatively prosperous, advanced economies and seeing third world-like situations.
Well, that's disturbing in and of itself that the IMF,
doesn't know, but they haven't been brought in. They've been dealing with Africa.
Yeah.
You know, and all of a sudden they're in Greece, and they see they're brought into Greece because Greece is suddenly on the brink. And they go and examine the books, and they realize the books are rigged. That this isn't, as they said, this isn't a first world country. This is a third world country. So I would start with phone calls and talking to people. So the great sources of information outside the countries were always the IMF and hedge fund managers that had been roaming around with an interest. And the hedge fund managers went to unbelievable lengths to understand what was happening.
You mean like Kyle Bass in the story
Told? Well, Kyle Bass, as we speak, has public opinion pollsters wandering around Germany trying to take the pulse of the German population to determine which way they're going to jump. But But I had a hedge fund manager friend in London, for example, who had hired a team of private investigators to unravel the dealings of Icelandic tycoons because you couldn't. There was no public declaration of these. So there was a wealth of information that had been dug out by people who were just trying to figure out what on earth is going on in here, because they look like black boxes from the outside, these countries. Once there, the amazing thing to me was people would talk to me. I mean, I always had it right for the Minister of Finance, and in some cases, the head of state. The Prime Minister of Iceland, you go knock on his door and you basically can get in, because there are only 300,000 people there. Everybody can go knock on his door. And there wasn't anybody who wouldn't talk to me. Everybody was, funny enough, in the financial, in the money world in these places, a lot of these people had read The Big Short and Liar's Poker. So I had a calling card, mm-hmm. and I could kind of get in. And I felt like in some cases I had unusual ability to talk to different kinds of people that within the society they weren't talking to each other, and that they themselves were befuddled about what had happened to them. So I would start, when I got there, I would usually start with the local financial people and the local government people who were trying to sort out the mess. But then it would just, one thing would lead to another. And before I knew it, I was with fishing captains in Iceland who had become currency traders, and you know, through the people would lead me places. Or them in Greece, the eureka moment for me came when I sat down with two tax collectors who were terrified that that I would name them. They wanted to remain anonymous, but they had big books of examples of tax fraud, and they worked in the tax collection agency. And their point was they'd sort of collected these as specimens, examples of everything that was wrong with their society. They weren't allowed to go do anything about it. That they sort of explaining to me that the quickest way to get fired as a Greek tax collector is to actually be good at collecting taxes.
It sounds like they had this sort of long history of what happens to taxes in Greece, but couldn't tell anybody about it.
That's correct. And so in Greece, so that leads to this awareness in Greece that there is a total moral crisis, that the relationship of the people to their government is totally screwed up. Everybody's cheating. You know, cheating has become normal. And
cheating on a personal level. I mean, in these other books and in these other places, the cheating is on a kind of global level where you're cheating with other people's money. But here it's sort of
very
mom
personal.
And pop
right,
cheating.
Right. Cheating became normal. And so then the question was, well, what generates moral outrage here? If the place is in moral collapse, what gets them riled up? And it turned out that there was this wonderful story to be told that was central to the whole Greek financial crisis. And it was a story of these monks at the Vatopedi Monastery in northern Greece who had essentially gamed the government for some real estate gains. And the exposure of this had caused the Greek government to fall. The new government, because the Greek government fell and the new government came in, was the only reason that the Greeks declared that they had this big financial problem. Otherwise, they would have tried to hide it for as long as they could. So the monks had actually triggered the Greek crisis because they caused the government to fall. And so the question was, the monks, what were these monks up to? You know, they got everybody so angry. And it turned out that they were doing nothing any different from anybody else in Greece, but they were just doing it much, much more effectively. and they were the Harvard Business School case study about how to game the Greek government. And they were doing it. The reason they were effective is, unlike most of the people who were gaming the Greek government, they were doing it for a higher purpose. They weren't doing it because they wanted to live high on the hog or make themselves comfortable. They lived miserably. But they had this ancient, glorious monastery they wanted to restore, and they needed funds to restore it.
What was it like to walk into that monastery and see? Had you known this story before you walked in, or was this something that you were finding out as you were?
It was all on the fly. It was that getting into this place was incredibly challenging. It's in the Vatopedi Monastery, is on Mount Athos in the north of Greece, and no women are allowed on the peninsula. No female animals
on the whole peninsula.
On the whole peninsula.
No female animals.
Animals of any kind except cats.
All right, we're getting back to that gender.
Yes,
thing
we are.
Going on.
We are. This runs through the story, and so I rolled in. I was not prepared. I was told, you know, I kind of, nobody arrives with luggage kind of thing. So all I had was this plastic bag from a hotel laundry bag with some Ambien and a toothbrush and toothpaste and a change of underwear in it over my shoulder. I get off this ferry and there's nothing but dirt roads going into the middle of nowhere, and I have no idea how to get to the Vatopari Monastery. It was an adventure just getting to the place. And when I go knocking on the door, they did a double take, because everybody there has 8 foot long black beards and hasn't taken a bath in a month, and all they do is pray for 15 hours a day. And I was this heathen in a mauve Brooks Brothers shirt with a plastic sack over my head, asking to be put up for the night because I wanted to talk to him about why everybody in Greece was angry at them. They were wonderful. They took me in. They took me in and talked to me and explained to me what they thought had happened. They were as cooperative as they could be.
So when you look at this, you know, there's such ingenuity here. It's just being used for purposes that bring things down rather than building things up. When you look at what's happened, say in Greece, is there a way to bring this back, to turn it around?
Well, you tell me, can a culture be remoralized so quickly? I mean, it seems to me the answer is no. Once you slip down that slope, climbing back up is a much longer process and usually involves enormous pain. You have to hit bottom before you come back up. And what you're seeing now, and which is affecting the U.S. markets right now, is the intransigence of the culture. That all these people from outside of Greece are telling the Greeks they need to behave. Germans are in there trying to collect taxes. Their austerity is being imposed on them. Their unemployment rate is skyrocketing. Their growth rate is falling, which is all very counterproductive. You know, in the short term, it's counterproductive because what it does is it reduces economic activity and increases the deficit. But in the long term, the attempt is to change the culture. It's called structural reform, but it's actually changing human behaviors and attitudes. And that is very hard to change. And what you've seen is at every turn, the Greek people stymieing the reform. They're told that the government says they agree to firing 100,000 government employees, and on paper they do it, but you find out that actually no, they just move them to another department off the books. And so it's been a very slippery process, and I know from people in the IMF that they go in there thinking that something's been done, and it hasn't been done. And at the same time, the Greek people are getting angrier and angrier and angrier. They're actually outraged that they're being put in this position. It's not encouraging.
As I hear you talk about that, it may not be right to make connections to what has gone on in this country, but I think about things that have happened just recently where, you know, many of us can't spend much money, but we're being told to spend more money. And there's a kind of sense of where does the responsibility lie? And people in this country, you know, you end your book, which is Tours of the New Third World in California.
Yes. Well, as I said, I regarded these European countries and the problems that they had and the temptations they succumbed to as echoes of our own problems. I was holding up a mirror to ourselves. And I thought the way the book would work, and it kind of does, but maybe it kind of doesn't, is that the reader, an American reader, would be laughing at the outrageous behavior of all these Europeans. And then come crashing to the end and realize that's us. You know, we're no better. And in fact, the Germans point this out in the book, that we used to hold you in the highest esteem. Your bankers, we used to held in the highest esteem. They've done nothing but come in here and rip us off in the last decade. You've been a horrible financial example to people. We're not going to listen to you anymore. So it was for me a way of indirectly writing about our own problems. And the book, the question was, where in America to end? And there's an analyst on Wall Street named Meredith Whitney who's done this very elaborate analysis of states and the relative likelihood of states not meeting their obligations or having real serious financial difficulty. And so she ranked them. And I asked her, you know, what's the scariest state? And she said, California. And so I thought, I'll end it there. I'll see what the scariest state looks like and why. And so I go on this journey starting at the top and working my way to the bottom, to a bankrupt city called Vallejo, and how they're dealing with having hit bottom. And And I suppose the sort of summary, the couple sentence summary of this journey is that, one, people are getting, Americans, as dire as it's all starting to look, have basically gotten what they want. They think they hate their government, and they think they hate their elected officials. California, the elected officials have been completely gelded, that we have basically direct democracy on every big fiscal issue. And the people are getting exactly what they want. What they want is to have public services and not pay for them. And that's unsustainable. It's an irresponsible electorate that is at the bottom of this. It's unrealistic expectations on the part of individual Americans that is at the bottom of this. And so it's a moral problem, which is a, well, it's a difficult problem to get your mind around. But the second thing that I kind of came away with, so the people who are trying to deal with this problem are all, as hard as it is to deal with the problem, are not despairing. And I think they're not. I think they're right not to despair, because what advantage we have over Europe is our narrative. We believe in reinvention and redemption and an ability to bounce off the bottom. When we hit bottom, we won't go up in flames. We'll figure it out. That's what I think. I think that when we hit bottom is when we'll start to reinvent ourselves. And our culture makes that much more likely than European culture. I mean, if you're declared bankrupt in Ireland, it's a life sentence. I mean, it's a really horrible thing to go through. Here, bankruptcy is made. It makes a second act possible.
Do you think that we need to hit bottom in order to bounce back? Is that something kind of as a country we need to be able to experience, to be able to then make the changes we have to make?
Yes. I think that we have lost our self-control, our ability to control ourselves. And you see it in many aspects of American life. That not every person in America, but as a generalization, our ability to control our appetites and our impulses and our ability to resist temptation is at a low. And I think the only way you kind of bounce from that is to suffer the consequences and feel some pain. It's a bit like weaning yourself of an addiction. And so I think why Vallejo, the city that's bankrupt, was so interesting to me is that it had actually hit the bottom, that it actually had experienced the pain. And I end the book with this firefighter in Vallejo. The public safety worker unions in California are in the middle of this problem. They've cut deals that are bankrupting the towns that they're supposed to serve. Like Wall Street people, they had power and they abused it. And the firefighter in Vallejo has been through a traumatic experience. He's seen his union bankrupt the city, his fighting force get cut in half, so that it's actually a dangerous place to be because it's underserved, and this firefighter gets appointed the new fire chief in Vallejo, and it looks like a really desperate situation. And his response is not to throw up his arms or quit and go to some more cozy job. His response is to figure out how to reinvent firefighting so you can do it with fewer resources and to accept less pay and all the rest. And you see in that, there's hope. There's hope.
I'm so glad you said that, because there's a lot of despair, but it's lovely that there is still hope. I have been speaking with Vanity Fair contributing editor Michael Lewis about his latest book, Boomerang, Travels in the Third World, which looks at how the cheap credit available over the last decade has contributed to our current financial downturn. It's published by W.W. Norton, and you can find a link to his latest article for Vanity Fair by going to the Leonard Lopate show page. Michael, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.